Our next speaker is Les Lankowski, who is president of the Institute for Educational Affairs in Washington, adjunct professor of public policy at Georgetown University, previously with the Smith Richardson Foundation, a consultant to Senator Moynihan, and assistant to the secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare. He has written extensively on the problems of poverty and the welfare state. Les?
Bill, I am glad to be back here at the Philadelphia Society. In fact, I was glad just to be able to leave alive the last time I spoke here. But I must confess that there is always something disorienting for me in coming to the Philadelphia Society. In Washington, where I live and work, I am regarded as some sort of right-wing ideologue, someone who would gleefully starve the hungry, throw women and children out on the streets, and do all sorts of other horrible things in the name of reforming the welfare state. When I come here, however, I tend to be regarded as a liberal or a collectivist or a statist or something, even though it's not always said so directly. For example, when Bill Venice wrote me last summer, ask me to present a paper on the role of the state in providing for welfare or public assistance, he informed me that Professor Mack would be a member of the panel and that he would take a rather strict, expected him to take a rather strict libertarian line. Then Bill wrote as follows, "I would expect your views to be different." Well, far be it for me to disappoint Bill Dennis. I will accept the charge. I do, in fact, believe that the state not only has a role in providing public assistance or welfare, but in carrying out that role should not and cannot be neutral with respect to social values. I will also argue ruefully that my view, alas, is not the path that I think the contemporary welfare state follows. To the contrary, it is more libertarian, or in the word Alan used earlier, individualist, than otherwise. I would differ with Alan, I think, primarily in believing that, in fact, the course that the current welfare state is on was one that it was on very early in its history, not something that is a recent phenomenon. Indeed, where he would point to Bismarck, I would point to Winston Churchill and a famous episode that occurred in the first decade of the 20th century. Churchill, as some of you may recall, began his political career as a social reformer, and as president of the Board of Trade and the Liberal government in Britain, he carried forward the nation's first unemployment insurance bill. To the great dismay of Beatrice and Sidney Webb, who until that time had been his patrons. From Webb's point of view, the notion of an insurance scheme that would pay people benefits once they were unemployed, once they became unemployed, was horrible to contemplate. There was no incentive, they wrote in a letter to Churchill, for the unemployed to get well and sicken the unemployed to get well and stay well in an insurance-based scheme, to which Churchill responded, defending his scheme, that he chooses not to mix his moralities with his mathematics, that is to say, the actuarial mathematics. Churchill won that round, social insurance won, the principle being that the proper role of the state in providing public assistance was that of a cashier, an instrument for collecting and paying assistance, not for insisting that those who receive that assistance take whatever steps are necessary so that they might be less in need of assistance in the future. This is true not just in Britain, but of course in the United States, where the primary act that created our version of the welfare state was the Social Security Act, a social insurance program accompanied as well by unemployment compensation. These are almost pure mathematical propositions. But in time as well, the idea of not confusing moralities with mathematics was extended to the public assistance or welfare programs, the income-tested programs. They were meant to be available for those people who would not be eligible for the major social insurance programs. This development occurred both through changes in law and especially through court decisions, most of which occurred in the 1960s, and to transform public assistance from a program that was meant to be, at least in the New Deal legislation, somewhat selective, somewhat conditional, to one that is today a near universal entitlement for public assistance, no less than for Social Security. What drives the system is money. In the case of Social Security, if you pay in, you take out regardless. In the case of public assistance, if you need it, you get it regardless. We have moved over time to reduce the amount of discretion in these programs and with it the ability of society to insist on certain values as a condition, certain kinds of behavior as a condition of the receipt of these benefits. Now, let me just qualify this assessment a bit. There is some degree of morality in these mathematics, and not all the values that are accompany these programs are bad ones either. Social Security, after all, the value expressed in such a program is that elderly people should live self-sufficiently in retirement. In welfare, public assistance is that parents should provide decently for their children, even if they have no income, earned income of their own. For some of the in-kind programs, such as food stamps or housing allowances, the value we transmit is that people should spend an adequate portion of their income on food or housing. But I think the overall effect of these public assistance programs is that the provision of aid also encourages many less laudable traits. Don't save for a rainy day. Only work if the job's a good one. And most importantly of all, in my opinion, don't really worry about providing for children should a breadwinner be of the family's income decline or the family not formed at all. Again, this is more true of public assistance than it is of but it is also a case of social insurance, especially insofar as, and it has happened steadily since 1935, social insurance departs from true insurance principles. Consequences of all this are visible, of course, a few blocks from here, and anyone who wishes to do so, I'd be glad to take on a trip to some of Chicago's finer public housing projects on the South Side. Now, recently, there has been much discussion about doing something to strengthen the moral components of welfare programs. There is now, it has just passed the Senate Finance Committee, a piece of legislation that will, among other things, create a policy that insists that welfare recipients, in exchange for welfare, should take work and training that will strengthen efforts to get parents who are absent to support their children. There have been other proposals suggesting that, indeed, for at least some people who might otherwise receive welfare, they should be expected to work first or instead of receiving welfare altogether. These are all statements that have occurred. They've developed over the last decade or so an effort to insist on obligation, in Larry Mead's phrase, as a crucial element of public assistance policy, that what we have been doing is one-sided. By providing assistance without asking anything in return, we've created more problems than we have solved. Public policy is now wrestling with the question of how to put into this system the kinds of requirements and sanctions that would add a sense of obligation to these programs. Are they likely to succeed? I don't mean simply legislatively. Well, there are practical difficulties of many sorts. In the interest of time, I won't even begin to enumerate them. It is much easier to talk about workfare or work and training programs than to make them work. It is much easier to insist that fathers should support their children than to get family court judges to enter child support orders, and so forth. But there's also that ultimate problem. Even with such sanctions, with such requirements, public assistance will still be provided. At best, there may be some financial penalty to someone who refuses to comply with the new rules, but even so, there will still be cash aplenty. That is why my good friend Charles Murray feels that the real solution has to lie in abolishing public assistance entirely, but even Murray believes that that is by no means a realistic proposal, and that one has to pursue second-best alternatives, such as adding requirements of one sort or another to the programs. George Gilder has described this approach as whistling in the dark, hoping that these addition of morality will make any difference whatsoever in the behavior of recipients. That may well be so, but at least the tune, perhaps, is a better one than the tune public assistance programs currently carry. In any case, what is the alternative? There is an alternative, but it lies outside of government. The state and its welfare programs are, thank goodness, not the only source of values. The private sector, especially philanthropic organizations or charitable organizations of various sorts, I'm leaving aside things like the family and religion in this, but certainly through the private sector, historically, there have been efforts to instill values as part of social welfare policy. Jim Gortney, for example, referred to this when he talked about the value of voluntary associations being able to tailor-make solutions to problems or to address cares that are beyond the reach of the state. We have always looked to the voluntary organizations, the charitable sector, for this. And the charitable sector, in turn, at least in the years ago, used to respond. During the 19th century, social welfare reformers indeed looked askance at public assistance. On the wall of the Buffalo Charity Organization Society, one of the main social welfare agencies at the time during the 19th century, was a sign saying, "No relief given here." That's not what social welfare agencies were about. Indeed, charity organizations, societies used to denounce the giving of aid to what they called the clamorous and the imprudent. They sought to identify the worthy, help to find employment, or refer to proper relief dispensing agencies those who could indeed receive aid and then proceed to get back on their feet. They fostered savings banks, day nurseries, other self-help projects. Indeed, the social welfare agencies of the 19th century were proud that all their money went for administration and not one cent to the poor. That's what it was supposed to be. That's the image we have in our minds of the role of the voluntary sector. Now, with respect to money going to administration, not much has changed with regard to voluntary. As Irving Kristol suggested last night, a lot else has. Originally, it was feared that the expansion of government welfare programs would displace charity. President Franklin Pierce in 1854, when he vetoed Dorothea Dix's bill, that would have created set aside public lands for asylums for the insane and the deaf, wrote that such an action would be prejudicial rather than beneficial to the noble offices of charity by drying up the normal springs of benevolence. President Pierce was wrong. As government giving has grown, in fact, charitable activity has also flourished. Right now, there are about 900,000 organizations that the Internal Revenue Service sees fit to call public charities. That includes religious organizations. If you exclude those, you've still got about 600,000. Most grant-giving foundations are not creatures of the 19th century. They were created after the Social Security Act of 1935. And other forms of charitable giving, individuals and corporations, have increased enormously as well. During the Reagan administration, charitable giving has grown at close to double-digit rates annually, despite the fact, as we all regret to say, the Reagan administration has not had much of an effect on the social welfare budget. Now, an economist, I think, would say, oh, yes, but there might be even more charitable giving if all these public programs hadn't come into being. And that may well be true. It's one of those propositions that strikes me as difficult, if not impossible, to prove. But nonetheless, it would be hard to think, to argue that the normal springs of benevolence have been dried up as a result of the increase in government provision of welfare. What has changed, however, is the character of charitable activity. As the welfare state has grown, philanthropic organizations have increasingly come to define their purposes and programs in relation to those of government. Indeed, the dominant characteristic of the voluntary sector is to assist and advance the role of government. This is manifest in a number of ways. For one, the so-called independent sector is heavily dependent financially on government. Something like 27% of the revenues of nonprofit charitable organizations are government revenues, federal, state, and local. And that does not include any implicit valuation of the tax exemption. This figure, by the way, also has not changed during the Reagan years. There are a number of good reasons why this dependency has occurred. Solve, save a certain amount of bureaucracy, expertise, and so on, but obviously there is the possibility, and I would submit the reality, of a loss of independence. The values of nonprofit organizations are increasingly the values of government itself. The second way they are dependent as well, and that is programmatically. To succeed, philanthropic organizations, and especially grant-giving foundations, increasingly feel they have to rely upon the public sector to take action. Part of this stems from the historical circumstances of the growth of foundations. They are an expression of the progressive era's faith in the value of expertise applied to social problems, that what philanthropy should do is to